Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis of our incomes, our jobs, our debts, all of that sort of thing. I've been your host these last 4.5 years producing this program. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. Let's jump right in these final days of August 2015, to the enormously interesting and tumultuous events of the last week. But before we get to the stock market, to China, to the oil markets, and the turmoil in all of them, let's talk about some of the other longer-term events that have also been coming to a head. I have stressed repeatedly that we are not in a recovery, or to be more precise, that the so-called economic recovery we've heard a great deal about in the media is really what has happened, until recently, of course, to the stock markets, to the profits of the big banks, to corporate profits, at least for bigger companies, but has bypassed, this recovery has, it has bypassed most Americans, as indeed it has bypassed most people in most of the countries affected and afflicted by this capitalist crash since 2008. And so I want to show you that this last week brought us a whole variety of more new evidence about this recovery for the few and no recovery for the many. I want to start by commending the folks in England, commending them for producing and now having an opportunity to visit a mock theme park. This one isn't called Disneyland. This is called Dismal Land. It's in Weston-super-Mare in England. Banksy is a famous artist leading a large group of artists who have basically created an artistic installation comprising an entire theme park devoted to honestly exploring what is happening to the real lives of most people rather than the fantasy life promoted by the Disneylands and Disney Worlds of our planet. It's an interesting comment that shows again that in the art world, as in everywhere else, a recognition of who's getting the recovery and who isn't is settling in and becoming clear. I want to mention also a report issued last week by the Century Foundation. Here's what it found, that over the last 10 or 15 years, and particularly these last few since the recovery, the concentration of poor people in ghettoized big cities and near suburbs of those big cities has actually gotten markedly worse. That's right. We're going back to the days of racial, ethnic, and income, low-income ghettos where we concentrate poor people so that the lack of money for them is compounded by the quality of the neighborhoods they live in, the pressures, the lack of public services, and so on. The Century Foundation's report, Growing Concentration of Poverty, is a must-read to understand the reality behind the hype of this kind of recovery. And finally, the Gallup poll, the most important or one of the most important polling agencies in the country. They released a poll taken for the week ending August 23rd. And there are many interesting things about the poll. But the one that I want to bring to your attention is what has happened basically since the beginning of 2015. Here we are, two-thirds of the way through the year. And here's what it shows, that the American people's notion of economic conditions currently and economic conditions in the near future has been going down without interruption. The interesting thing is not only that people's concept of what's happening is going down, and in my judgment, this shows that the American people understand exactly correctly what's been going on, have not, in fact, been fooled by the recovery hype, much as the people at the top need to keep repeating it. Even more interesting in the Gallup poll ended August 23rd is the fact that the outlook, what people expect of the economic future, is markedly worse than what they believe is going on in the present. Both what they believe is happening in the present and what they believe will happen in the future have gone down, but their notion of the future is even grimmer than their notion of the present. Evidences of all kinds that the recovery isn't. Let me turn next to a frightening topic. It's the fires in the west of the United States. I want to say something about the economics of these fires. First, the raw details. In Washington state, fire covers nearly 500 square miles. Smoke from that fire has been detected as far east as Chicago. That's from Washington state to Chicago. That's almost two-thirds of the distance across the United States. August 19th, Washington Governor Jay Inslee asked for a federal disaster declaration, which he got. In California, it's even wider and worse. Fires have been burning since early July, and 42 large fires are active now. By mid-August of this year, fires have consumed 7.2 million acres nationwide, mostly in Alaska. An unprecedented 32,000 men and women are struggling to control these flames. Estimates are it will cost taxpayers $25 billion, that's with a B, dollars, to contain this kind of thing. So what's the economics here of this? Well, it's clear the damage is huge, economically speaking. The cost of containing these fires is huge, economically speaking. Those are resources that are not going to be available for all kinds of other things this society of ours needs. What causes these terrible fires? As best I can tell, three things, all of which have their economic dimensions too, which is why it's worth talking about. First is global warming. That's right. If you throw pollution into the air in your technology and in the way you produce, and you don't take the steps needed to prevent or at least limit it, you're going to increase the temperature in the world. And guess what? That contributes to, you write, forest fires. Number two, if you have a chaotic, profit-driven housing industry that builds houses wherever it can make money doing it, you're going to see the houses move further and further into the woodlands. You're not going to think about that problem. You're not going to substitute houses that are clumped together, apartment houses, apartment complexes, precisely because they don't intrude on the land as much as single-family sprawls. You're not going to worry about that, and that's going to mean that the damage caused by a fire as it burns through these single-family homes on the edges of forests is going to be much worse. So that it's partly the way our economy works that then generates these enormous costs of these fires. But there's a last dimension that I want to concentrate on. There are beautiful and historic stories being told of people whose homes or pets have been saved by the intervention of these firefighters, these 32,000 people. They all work, these 32,000, for the government. That is, either the government hires them or the government is supervising the fire effort, and they work in coordination and under the direction of governmental agencies. It's an important reminder that the crazed notion that everything in a society is somehow better off if it is done by the private sector rather than the public sector is such a terrible disservice to the way we live. These fires, which threaten millions of our fellow citizens, have been, are being contained and limited by people working in and through collective effort run by the government. And everyone involved is grateful for it. I'm reminded of the old story of the farmers in New England and the Midwest who were self-reliant individualists, if ever there were any. And then they discovered that in order to have their farms successful and grow, they needed, besides the shed where the chickens were kept, and besides the houses where they lived, they needed something called a barn, a big structure to handle their cows, their storage needs, their hay, you name it. And guess what? For each individual farmer to build a barn would take months. And he or she couldn't do that. They had to tend to the animals. They had to tend to the fields. They couldn't get the barn done individually, even though they each needed it. They found a solution. They did the work collectively. They all got together and built barns for each of them separately. 50 farmers working on John's barn could get it built in a weekend. What they could do collectively, each of them needed individually. What they needed individually, they couldn't do for themselves individually. So they did it collectively as a community project. You might want to call that socialism, but whether you do or not, it is a real practical necessity and blessing taught to us again by these awful fires in the West. Last week, we talked a little bit about Amazon Corporation, and we talked about the expose of the awful working conditions. Well, in the wake of that, people have been looking at Amazon some more, and Bloomberg, the financial service, published an article on the 24th of August devoted to Amazon's pension plans for its workers. Suzanne Woolley, Margaret Collins, and Spencer Soper were the three authors, co-authors, of this article about Amazon's 401 plan, which they dubbed pretty brutal too, like working conditions there. And I learned something that I wanted to share with you. First, Amazon, when it has a pension for its workers, has money taken out of their paycheck to put into the pension, and then they quote-unquote match it. But what's really interesting is the amount of the match is a good bit less than other companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook, and so on. Even more interesting, the matching isn't in money. The matching is in stocks of the Amazon Corporation, which ties the fortunes and the pensions of the workers there to how well that stock does. If you remember the Enron Corporation, that can be a recipe for no pension at all if and when the company's stock heads south, like, oh, I don't know, last week, for example. But what struck me the most was who gets a pension working at Amazon and who does not. From the Bloomberg article, here's the reality. The permanent staff working in the warehouses of Amazon numbers 40,000 workers. They are eligible for this not very generous and all in Amazon stock pension program. But Amazon relies on, get ready, 80,000 seasonal workers. Two seasonal workers for every permanent workers. And that's right, you guessed it, seasonal workers aren't eligible even for this poor and poorly constructed pension. Amazon, leading corporation that doesn't normally tell you about these things. Let me turn now to the question of the stock market turmoil of the last week. What is going on? Why these violent up and down movements? What is this instability in the stock market about? And why should it concern us? Let me begin by making clear who's affected directly and indirectly by all this craziness. And there I'm going to use an interesting article by Cole Stangler on the 25th of August in the International Business Times. 14% of Americans own individual stocks, 1 out of 7. That means the other 6 out of 7 Americans don't own individual stocks and are therefore not affected by one or another of them going up sharply or dropping catastrophically. It's true a larger number of Americans have some dabbling in mutual funds, groups of shares that some company puts together for them. Typically, that's something people own in their pension accounts or their pension funds maintained by their employers, etc. But clearly, here's an important reality. The majority of Americans don't have any involvement in the stock market. They neither own individual stocks, nor do they have any mutual funds or collections indirectly. And the simple reason is that the majority of people do not have the money to do it. There's no great mystery about that. But everybody is affected indirectly. Companies whose shares zoom up or drop down will behave differently. They'll hire more or fewer people. They'll expand or not. They'll move out of the country sooner or later. They will change their technology. They will find it harder or easier to borrow money. So we will all be affected by how the companies react to the instability of the stock market. We depend on that market even if we don't directly have the assets enabling us to participate in it, as most Americans do not. So much for people's capitalism, a fanciful idea further from reality today than it has been even in our recent past. So what happened? Well, a great deal of finger-pointing aimed at China. It was convenient for American commentators in the mass media to blame the Chinese as if they had some particular role to play. Well, they played a role, but they're not to blame for this any more or less than the United States or any other part of a global capitalist system that now works in an interdependent way. Let me explain. China has indeed become a very important part of the world economy. It's the number two industrial power after the United States. So whatever happens in China will impact the rest of the world, and that's true for the United States as well. So what's the story in China? Again, to simplify, but to get to the essentials, here it is. For the last 20 years, China has been the great success growth story of the world. That country, ruled by a communist party, has grown economically faster than anyone else in the world, faster than anyone foresaw 25 years ago, to become the number two economy. And they did that in two ways. Number one, they decided to build their industrialization around exports. They would produce products for the rest of the world. The Chinese people themselves were too poor to buy the flood of output that Chinese industrialization achieved. For that to happen, they had to be able to sell all that stuff, and that could only be done in the rich parts of the world, Western Europe, North America, Japan, and wealthy pockets elsewhere in the world. So in that way, the Chinese economy became dependent on the ups or downs of the capitalist world in Western Europe, North America, and Japan. Number two, in order to industrialize quickly, the Chinese invited in big multinational capitalist corporations, American, British, French, you name it, Japanese, and so on, to partner with the Chinese in building up their industries. So they became, the Chinese did, dependent on capitalism in two key ways. They would export to the capitalist world, and they would partner with capitalist corporations inside China. This worked well. They built their economy at a breakneck pace, huge cities propping up all over China to become the world's number two industrial power. They made so many profits that they recycled them, took their profits from selling everything to the rest of the world, and lent a large amount of it to the United States, which is why today the United States is the largest debtor country in the world, and the People's Republic of China is the number one creditor of the United States. Capitalist country in debt, communist-led country is the lender. Think about it, because It's a reality that has to be coped with. Well, this is a story about capitalism. It's a story about China's dependence on foreign capitalists coming in to build, as well as foreign capitalist countries to buy. If you make your economy dependent on capitalism, you really can't be surprised if you suddenly suffer instability, business cycle, upturns, downturns, often violent and extreme as the last 2 weeks have been. Why? Because that's been the history of capitalism everywhere it has arrived for 250 years. Every effort of the economics profession, of which I am a part, to overcome, to stop, to prevent these business cycles has failed. We still have them. We have not learned from the horrors of the 1930s, nor from the collapse in 2008, how to prevent these sorts of things, and therefore they keep happening. They happen because it's capitalism. The fact that this capitalism has now spread to include China and that therefore the cycles in China happen and impact us here in the United States should surprise no one. Let me underscore that a key part of this game was the fact that the Chinese opened themselves to the capitalists of the West by offering cheap labor. Factory after factory, offices, stores, closing in the United States to open a more profitable business in China. The capitalists who did that didn't understand the norms of their own system. So they overbuilt capacity. They were so eager to make more money, they set up factories with more capacity than the world economy can bear. At the same time, they didn't figure, gee, if we leave the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, where wages are high, and build capacity, increasing the ability of the world to produce, while paying workers less, the very extra capacity will not find a buyer. And true enough, we now have serious troubles in China and everywhere else because the capacity built up by capitalists is way ahead of the ability of people to buy, depressed by capitalists moving from high to low wage industries. Is this a story of capitalist dysfunctionality? You bet. This is a crisis of capitalism, again, as it works. This is not about China any more particularly than it has been about capitalists going anywhere else in the world where they have achieved the same thing. If you do not want an unstable economy bursting up and down in the way of the scary headlines of the last 2 weeks, your problem is the system that always has and continues to generate exactly that kind of instability. Over the last 5 years, as we have reeled from the capitalist downturn of 2008, and as governments have pumped unprecedented amounts of money into the economy, that money found its way into speculating in stocks. Because that's how capitalism works. Driving the prices of the stocks higher than the underlying economy justified. So it was only a matter of time, as many observers pointed out, before there'd have to be what they like to call in the financial news a correction. That is, a sudden drop in prices to reflect the fact that the speculation intrinsic to capitalism had driven up the prices of stocks beyond anything that could be justified in the longer run. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. Please stay with us when we return in a very short amount of time for the second half, when we will go through a number of major issues that have been in the news, particularly the oil crisis, because it's related to the turbulence in stock markets and because it has its own significance for the economic lives we lead.
Damn. by the river, I was drawn by your grace into depths of oblivion and to the lover's place. I was stuck in a puddle full of tears and unwise. Stuck doing snow, know that we fade unlike, honey, I know. Hey, when we walked out alone, I feel like we can throw away the forces of a past. And I know, too, it's been the hardest days for you. Let's throw them out the window, that's what those lovers do.
To the second half of today's edition of Economic Update. I want to pick up where we left off in the first half of the program and talk a little bit more, not about the stock market turbulence, as we did in the last half hour, but about a closely related topic, which is the turbulence in the oil markets around the world. It was correctly said by some observers to the stock market craziness of the last 10 days or so, that part of it is related to the disruption in the world because of the catastrophic drop of oil. The price of oil, a barrel of oil in the world over the last year, has lost more than half its value. That's an enormous drop in the price of something so essential and so basic to the modern world economy as petroleum. Any drop of that sort will have serious repercussions on everyone affected by it, and that will require adjustments by countries, by companies, and by individuals. So let's take a look at the turbulence in the oil markets and how they connect to the larger issues of our economy today. Well, the basic reason why the oil prices went crazy downward, collapsing by well over half, losing more than half their value, is not such a difficult story to tell. It is a story, if you will allow me, of supply and demand. The supply of oil really shot up in the last few years. I will explain that in a moment. At the same time, the demand for oil went south. Shrank. Well, it doesn't take rocket science, as I like to say, to understand that if more and more oil is looking to be sold, and at the same time fewer and fewer buyers are available to buy it, that the price is going to tumble. You might wonder, and certainly you ought to, didn't the capitalist companies that account for most of the oil market in the world, didn't they foresee this? The answer, not at all. Not at all. They didn't plan for it. They didn't prepare for it. They didn't know how to respond to it. And as I'll explain in a minute, that's making everything even worse. So let's talk about it. The major cause of the increase in oil supply in the world is the United States. The chief reason is shale oil. All that news you've been reading about fracking, this dangerous procedure of pumping gases and chemicals into the soil to force up oil and gas, has produced a vast new source of oil being pumped up and sold into the market. Oil from Canada and the United States, above all, led by the United States, the major producer. The United States pumped more and more oil. Companies borrowed huge amounts of money from banks, making the banks dependent on the oil business. And they used that money to build pipelines, to set up drilling rigs, to invest in the expensive technology of bringing that oil up, and to a much lesser degree, trying to cope with the ecological disaster it represents. The end result of this borrowing and this investing and this production was to increase the supply of oil, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years. Interestingly, at the same time, we've had a global economic crash starting in 2008, which has produced serious economic downturns in the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and eventually even in the more robust economies of China, India, Brazil, and so on. That means that the economic activity in those parts of the world was reduced. That's why unemployment has been a big problem in Western Europe, North America, and Japan. That's why the failure of people to be able to borrow the way they used to means they can't buy the way they used to either. To make a long story short, the demand for goods and services has in fact shrunk. The money isn't there to deal with the supply of oil. The demand for oil has gone down and the supply has increased. And the result of that is a collapse in the price. Now, you might have expected, if you've studied economics, that if the price goes down, well, then maybe there'll be less produced. The problem is that many of the producers can't afford to do that. Even if the price goes down, they have to keep pumping oil because they borrowed money to run the oil rigs. And they have to pay interest on that debt. And even if they can't make as much as they did before, if they don't pump oil, they'll be earning nothing. And then they'll have to default on their debts. And that will mean they can never borrow again, or at least not easily. And it plunges the banks into a dilemma. They don't want that either. You can see the network of interests that keep pumping oil even as the price goes down. We've been watching that now for the last year. The decline in oil production, and there's been one, is nowhere near enough to prevent oil from following. Now, there were many in America who seemed to have imagined that this increase in oil coming from the United States would somehow not produce a collapse in prices. The only way that might have happened is if the rest of the world accommodated the United States and produced less so that the overall supply wouldn't be increased. That is, the United States would produce more and the rest of the world less. That would be, of course, wonderful for the United States, able to produce all the extra oil and sell it at the good old high price. And it would be a disaster for all the other oil-producing countries, since they would be cutting back their production and selling it at the same old price. guess what? And this is a really hard thing to imagine. The other countries were not willing or able to do that. They weren't going to collapse their economies by selling much, much less oil. By the way, these are countries that overwhelmingly depend on selling oil much more than the United States does. So countries like Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Venezuela, and Mexico are having huge economic problems because they were A, not willing to cut back production simply to make the United States rich while they became impoverished, but they too have been, therefore, pumping oil because they don't want to give up what's called market share to the United States. This is a recipe for disaster. And I want to draw the conclusion, precisely because so much in the mass media doesn't. The conclusion is that something as fundamental to us all, petroleum, that powers our factories, that drives our vehicles, that heats our homes, has been left to the ups and downs of capitalist corporations interacting in capitalist markets, sometimes with countries. The end result of that system has been chaos, a collapse in the price of oil that has shaken countries like Russia to its foundations, likewise Venezuela, now likewise even Saudi Arabia, and so on. It has shaken the Midwest of the United States, which thought it had entered a long-term boom and is now discovering what it's like to be in at least a short-term bust that has left tens of thousands without work, communities without revenue, and no prospects in the near future. It is chaos what this economic system produces. Something as important as oil, the production should be organized and planned. It should be done in coordination with reasonable estimates of the need for the oil. And as the need changes, the production is adjusted. We don't need or want the level of chaos that we're now going through. And a chaos that not only affected the oil business, but affected whole countries dependent on oil, and affected, of course, the stock market as everyone began speculating on this or that company because it was affected in this or that way by the crazy gyrations of the price of oil. Leaving oil is a little bit like leaving food to the market and to capitalists' competition. They can game the system. And they do. And they make decisions based on their estimates of what's profitable. When those decisions lead to disastrous outcomes, not just disastrous for the rest of us, but often disastrous for them too, we like to end up blaming oil itself or China or Saudi Arabia but it's not a problem of this or that player in the system. The problem is the system. Each of the players is doing what this system rewards, trying to avoid what this system punishes. If their behavior leads to unwelcome outcomes, the problem is the system. And it has a name, capitalism. And we really do have to grow up as a country and a nation, and begin to debate and analyze the acceptability or not of capitalism as the system through which we do the basic things of life, like produce and distribute food, produce and distribute energy, and so on. Another issue that you've asked me about comes back perennially, and so I thought I would devote a few minutes today again to it, has to do with tax exemption for wealthy institutions. And again, I'm going to use universities because they're a prime example. And I want it to be clear to everyone how this system works, a system that is cultivated by these rich institutions. And let's give them the name so we all know what I'm talking about. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Duke, University of Chicago, and so on. These are the richest top universities. University of Texas shouldn't leave them out, and so on. The best example for me is Yale University, and that's simply because I went to school there, I taught at Yale University, and I'm very familiar with the economics. Yale depends on the government. It is a private institution in name only. What do I mean? Here's what I mean. Number one, the largest source, single source of income for Yale over most of the last 30 years, each year, has been government grants. That's right. Let me say that again. Federal government, the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Health, Education, Welfare, you name it, grants coming from those institutions of government flow into Yale. If you're a researcher at Yale, you get together with some other professors, you apply for support for your research. The way a research grant works is you get the money, let's say $2 million, to do your research, but Yale is allowed and does attach an increase above that, a markup, which it takes for itself. It calls that overhead or the university's need. That's how the university gets a huge amount of its money. More usually in most of those years than it collects from all tuition, room, and board payments by all students, undergraduate and graduate, combined. But that's only the beginning of Yale's dependence on the government for what it is and does. Here's the second example. The private money that Yale gets, the donations from wealthy people, the donations from corporations, those are tax-exempt to the donor. What does that mean? Very simple. If I'm a millionaire and I give Yale $1 million and I live, say, in New York City, then the million I give to Yale, I can deduct from my income for income tax purposes. If I live in New York City, I pay a federal income tax, a state income tax to New York State, and a tax to New York City. Three income taxes for people living in New York City. When you figure out the total percentage of your income that goes for tax, it's around 50%. That means if I give Yale $1 million, it reduces my income taxes by $500,000. So the cost to me of giving Yale $1 million is $500,000. The government loses half of what I give to Yale. I'm a millionaire. Yale is a university with 20-odd billions in the bank, an endowment of 20-some billion dollars. So one wealthy, rich entity, me, gives another rich entity, Yale, $1 million, and it costs the government, whose job it is to serve everybody, $500,000. The donor saves half of what he gives. The government's ability to take care of everybody is damaged, impoverished, reduced when one wealthy person gives a wealthy institution, like a university, money. There's something terribly wrong with this story. But of course, the universities love it because it's an incentive for wealthy people who would like to see, for example, their name on a library or their name on a building, or perhaps their relatives get a little extra boost to get into these institutions or whatever, look good to their friends. It only costs them half of what they give the university to get all those things. They're pleased. The university loves it. the government in our country doesn't say anything about it. Listen to the candidates for president and note down how often they talk about this scandalous situation, which, by the way, involves billions of dollars. You'll notice they talk about it approximately never. We're still not done. When Yale or any other institution like that gets a donation of money or stocks or real estate, and it uses that to make money, Yale, being a tax-exempt institution itself, is not required to pay any tax on the income it earns. So not only do rich people get to give the Yale money that only costs them half of whatever they donate, but Yale, in turn, can use that money to make money and pays no taxes. A $25 billion corporation, because that's what Yale roughly is, doesn't pay any taxes to the federal government or to the state government, Connecticut in the case of Yale. We're still not done. Yale owns property. Yale is an institution of 200-odd buildings scattered over the city of New Haven and several other cities. It's an immense property. It's the largest property owner in the city of New Haven. How much property tax does it pay on its property in New Haven? The part of its property that it calls educational, that's about 97, 98% of it, pays no property taxes to New Haven. Let's get this clear in our heads. New Haven is a city of 120,000 people. It has the dubious distinction of being one of the 10 poorest cities in the United States. That's measured by the U.S. Census Bureau. It counts the number of people, families, living below the poverty line as a percentage of the total number of families in the community. By that measure, New Haven is one of the 10 poorest cities. You know why it's poor? Here's one big fat reason. Because its largest employer, Yale University, its largest landowner, Yale University, pays exactly no property taxes. A poor family pays property taxes on its house. A poor family pays property taxes to New Haven on its car. But Yale, a $25 billion corporation, doesn't pay property taxes on its fleets of vehicles or on its land or its buildings or anything else. When you put together the exemption to its donors, the exemption of its own income-generating activity, and the grants it gets from the government, to call Yale a private institution is a reflection of not understanding how this game works. Yes, game. Because what these institutions are very wealthy gamers of the system. They impoverish in a significant way the communities in which they live, the states in which they function, and the country they pretend to serve. I taught at Yale. I went to school at Yale. I also went to school at Harvard and at Stanford. So I'm a product of these institutions. And I could see that the economics they taught me, when applied to what they do, yielded the kind of grotesque injustice that I have just begun to analyze. This is outrageous. And now a little history about all of this. Why did universities ever get tax exemption? Well, it goes back to our colonial days, when Harvard and Yale, some of our oldest universities, were first put together. I'll give you the story for Yale, but it isn't that different for any of the others. In the case of Yale, we're talking about colonial days. Population of Connecticut was small, rural, poor. The folks in Connecticut, many of whom had run away from Britain for religious reasons, were very concerned to erect Protestant churches in their communities in Connecticut. The problem was they didn't have the money or they didn't want to spend the money on the churches they would have liked to see. So here's what they did. They got together and they passed laws in Connecticut, as they do in other states. And the laws said, we want a church in our towns, and here's what we're going to do to help make a church happen. We're going to exempt the church from paying taxes. That'll make the finances of the church a little easier. And we're going to do that knowing that the benefit of having the church is immediately available for the community that agrees to do without the taxes. So in a sense, the people in a town, like the folks in New Haven, Connecticut, the home of Yale, said something like, we will get a church which we want, and we'll pay for it by letting them not pay taxes to the community of New Haven the way all the rest of us do. The idea being, you give a tax exemption because you get a service that the community wants in return. All right, let's use that logic. Does the University of Yale today serve the local community the way the School for Ministers, which is how Yale began, served in the first place? And the answer is no. The Divinity School, which exists at Yale, is a tiny, inconsequential corner of that immense institution. Not only that, but it trains ministers not for New Haven and not for Connecticut, but for the whole world. It makes, therefore, no sense for the people of New Haven to give Yale a pass on its property taxes because of what Yale does for the community, because Yale long ago stopped being focused on New Haven for anything other than garbage pickup and fire services. Wow. Let's recap. If Yale paid property taxes, the same as any working class family pays for its house in one or another corners of that city, it would yield to New Haven somewhere between 70 and 100 million bucks. That would transform the city of 120,000, allow it to do things in its public schools it has never been able to do, representing a real contribution of Yale to the community, exceeding anything and everything that institution has ever done for its host community. For Yale, it's a small part of their budget. It would make little or no difference. Yale's budget is over $1 billion a year. And even if it did affect Yale, that's what it means to live in a democratic society. You pay your share. Yale absorbs the bulk of public services in New Haven. It just doesn't contribute. The poor in New Haven, the middle class, they all pay higher taxes because Yale doesn't pay hardly any at all on 95% or 97% of its property. That means that the people of New Haven, among the 10 poorest cities in America, New Haven, the poor people of New Haven pay taxes for the public services delivered free of charge to Yale. When a Yale professor needs a cop, he gets one. When Yale needs a fire truck to come and help control a fire, they get one. When Yale sends kids to public schools, they get the teacher. You get the picture? Yale gets public services and doesn't pay for them. This is a tax structure that is so upside down that in New Haven, the city's relationship to Yale has been characterized as Robin Hood in reverse. You steal from the poor and you give to the rich. Tax exemption for wealthy institutions is an old idea whose time came and went centuries ago. It is only held on to because it's a way for aggrandizing institutions like Yale and Harvard and Stanford and Duke and Texas and so on, making them free to grab hold of as much public money as they can with the least responsibility to the larger community from which they draw such a huge portion of their resources. We've come to the end of our program. Please make use of our websites, rdwolf2fs.com, and our newly relaunched and redone democracyatwork.info. These are websites where you can contact us, where you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I want to thank truthout.org for that enormous service that they provide to all of us, news, analysis. I want to thank them, and I want to thank all of you for coming back week after week, for sending us your comments, your criticisms, for making this a partnership. I want to particularly thank those of you that have called in with radio stations that might be interested in carrying our program. And finally, I want to remind you that I will be traveling this autumn. I'll be coming to the following places if you can catch us there. All of this will be posted on our websites in the next week or two if it's not already there. I will be going to Tampa, Florida, Kansas City, Missouri, Fresno, California, Ames, Iowa, Seattle, Washington, Berkeley, California, and I will be announcing some more as they get finalized. Thank you again for your attention and your interest and your support. Until next week, Economic Update, Richard Wolf. Have a good week.
Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. They ain't gonna change. Yes, it is.
Hey, Missy.
Oh, hi, Anthony.
So are you set for Saturday?
What? This Saturday, the 29th?
Yeah.
Just remind me, what's happening on Saturday?
It's when we put some of the almost finishing touches on the uprising of the downtrodden. You know, the radio script we've been working on.
Of course, I knew that. It's still going to be at 4 in the afternoon again?
Yes, same time, same place at 388 Atlantic Avenue, third floor in the Brooklyn Commons building.
Oh, yes. At WBAI. And exactly what are we going to be doing?
We will be creating the climax.
Ooh, I like climax.
No, not that kind of climax. It's like a literary climax.
Oh, you mean the final part of the radio play.
Exactly. So folks can come by and contribute to the ending of the audio drama, which will be presented live at the Brooklyn Commons Performance Space next month, Thursday, September 17th at 7 p.m.
I'll be there.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI